For some of us, commuting may become a thing of the past. And for some, this is great news. Remember being stuck in traffic? If you've already ready to forget all that stress and actually prefer driving less, consider donating a vehicle you no longer need to WMNF. It's easy and free. Learn more at WMNF.org. Good morning, this is Talking Animals. Got a little bit of a different CD player here situation. Sorry, so just getting my opening music underneath us here squared away. So this is Talking Animals on WMNF. My guest today is Dr. Chris Pockel, a veterinary behaviorist based in Portland, Oregon, the owner and primary clinician of the Animal Behavior Clinic there. Pockel worked as a general practitioner for 2 years after graduating from vet school, then began a behavior residency program, later becoming board certified by the American College of Veterinary Behaviors. In addition to running a specialized veterinary practice, Pockel lectures at conferences and other events across the U.S. and Canada, has taught courses in veterinary behavior at vet schools, and has contributed chapters to books dealing with behavior issues. He's developed other expertise, including animal aggression. We'll delve into the realm of the veterinary behaviors, including asking about the behavior of specific animals. Maybe you'd like to ask about the behavior of your animals when I speak with Dr. Chris Pockel in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. A booking that happened at the suggestion, by the way, of Glenn Hatchell, so my thanks to him. Later in the program, I'll speak with Majid Magic Ishmaili, proprietor of Zaxi Bird Sanctuary, a 5-acre facility in Tampa housing some 200-plus parrots. Owing to a dispute with one of his neighbors, Ishmaili alleges that the access road he and others had used to get in and out of the sanctuary is now blocked. So he's isolated and struggling to keep the birds fed and cared for by himself, as volunteers who used to help him have stopped coming. We'll hear some specifics from Ishmaili about this predicament later in the program. Right now, though, let's step into the world of veterinary behaviorism with Dr. Pockel, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Dr. Chris Pockel on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Dr. Pockel.
Good morning, sir. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well, and really so pleased to have you here on Talking Animals. And I know since I'm talking to you from Portland, that involves getting up, or at least getting on the phone early, so I appreciate it all the more.
Absolutely. I mean, you're in luck that I'm generally speaking a pretty early riser and a morning person to boot.
So, that's great.
Perfect time of day for me.
Okay, awesome. So let's just jump in. Were you one of those people who was sort of destined from childhood to become a veterinarian?
Sure was.
Yeah. So the guy tending to injured animals as a kid, that kind of thing, or?
Yeah, it was certainly, you know, one of the only memories I have in terms of, you know, what are you going to be when you grow up? It was sort of just a transparent, yep, I'm going to be a veterinarian. I don't even think I knew at that point in time what that even really meant. But, you know, thankfully everything continued down that path, and I've been more than thrilled with all of the opportunities and the experiences that I've been able to have along this journey.
Well, we're certainly going to, of course, talk about many of those in the next little while here. But one of the things that's interesting is that over the years here on this show, I've spoken with so many people who, at least as they were kids, thought and said much the same that you did. Hey, I'm going to be a veterinarian. And then they did veer off that path. I mean, often, obviously, if they're on the show, still dealing with animals in some capacity. But it sounds like you were single-minded and unwavering in your thought, even if you didn't quite know what being a veterinarian meant, that you were going to become one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and I grew up in a very small town in northern Minnesota, and, you know, so didn't have a tremendous amount of access to that world. It's not like I was able to, you know, shadow a vet or, you know, do ride-alongs or things like that, but, you know, thankfully had some good role models early on and some great opportunities to provide more.
I don't know if any of you are dog people.
It just built on itself, and, yeah, it's been an epic ride so far.
So why do you think if you were kind of in a smaller town and there weren't really, sounds like direct examples of veterinarians or someone you would sort of like respond to in that way, why do you think that early on that still nonetheless became sort of a lifelong passion that you, of course, obviously realized?
You know, it's a great question. And I truthfully don't know the answer. I know that I did a lot of reading as a kid. I, you know, always had a book in front of me. And so there were so many sort of young adult books around dogs and horses and, you know, birds and all these different animal types. And so there was this fascination with them and their, you know, and their health and their care and these relationships that we were able to build with them. And so I think that was probably the starting point. And, you know, truthfully, you know, without sort of skipping over, you know, decades of experience, I'll be honest in saying that I got into veterinary medicine because of my love for animals. But I actually, in hindsight, made the transition into veterinary behavior because of my relationship with people and the relationship with my clients and helping them through some of the struggles that they were working on. So it's really been an interesting sort of multi-species look at how all of these relationships exist and sort of what are the merits of individual relationships throughout this entire process.
Well, so you have anticipated somehow exactly kind of my next key question, because I was struck by sort of one significant detail early in your career path that you I think I mentioned in the opening. You graduated from vet school, and not exactly a breezy educational experience from what I understand. You began practicing as one would expect, but far less expected is that 2 years into practicing, you then began a behavior residency program. So why was that? What was the lure? What pulled you in that direction after you had already completed vet school, started practicing for a couple of years, and then said, hey, hold on, this is actually something new that I'm going to do?
Yeah, you know, it was a light bulb moment or a series of light bulb moments. And when I started my career in general practice, you know, I was sort of done with school, at least at that point. I'm like, okay, I really kind of want to settle in and I want to start building lifelong relationships with my clients. I'm looking for that. I want that experience. And so when I graduated, I had zero expectation of going back into residency or doing any additional specialization. And yet, as I started to dive a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper into behavior specifically and how many cases that I would see on a routine daily basis, you know, for annual exams, these behavior questions kept coming back. And I was like, man, I need to know more about this if I'm going to be able to really help my clients. And so it started a bit sort of organically, and through some additional continuing education opportunities that I had, I remember having this light bulb moment of, I think this is it. I think this is what I'm supposed to do next. And really from that point in sort of early 2004, started looking at additional career opportunities and really never looked back.
So Dr. Pockel, as you were kind of sorting this out and saying, hey, I'm you know, kind of a slowly illuminating light bulb moment, it sounds like in some ways, was there something going on with a certain animal in your professional life and or personal life that began sort of that sequence and underscored it maybe, where you thought, hey, I'm starting to see stuff, patterns, repeats, whatever, and this is really interesting to me and maybe makes me think this is kind of where I should get a little more training and focus my efforts from that point forward in that realm?
You know, there were, and I remember, you know, now this is going back to, you know, 2003, 2004, so, you know, gosh, you know, 16, 17 years ago, and I remember several of my cases, including one of them, which was a, you know, I would say it was a pattern that I saw somewhat frequently, where I had a couple who had a couple of small kids, and they had this adolescent Labrador that was, probably the short story is, more dog than what they knew how to handle, and they just didn't have the training foundations. And I remember having this conversation with this woman in my office. She was in tears saying, man, we love this dog, and I just don't think this is going to work for us. And so together we started exploring some options and said, you know, hey, if we try this. And, you know, fast forward 3 months, 6 months, you know, we magically hit on the right combination through luck or skill. I'm not sure at this point. And, you know, turned that corner and, you know, there it was, right? We had the ability to really change the outcome. And I had another case where it was a single woman who had three small little white Maltese dogs, and they were starting to squabble amongst the three of them. And I can remember my conversations again saying, hey, well, let's tease this out a little bit. Let's dive into the relationships between these dogs and see if we can help support one of them differently than what we're doing. And let's see if that impacts, again, the relationships that are there. And, you know, again, comes back and says, wow, like I had no idea that making some relatively small changes could have such lasting impact. And, you know, and I remember having, you know, this conversation where she's in tears in my office. And I was so struck by the ability to impact the lives of the people that I was working with through the vehicle of veterinary medicine, specifically through the vehicle of veterinary behavior. And I thought, man, number one, there's a tremendous opportunity here. And number two, I think I actually might be kind of good at this. So let's explore and see what we can do.
Yeah. So it sounds like almost kind of a multi-tiered light bulb moment. It's like, hey, this is cool. I'm seeing what the impact is. And not coincidentally, perhaps, I'm seeing that I probably have a bit of a gift for it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Dr. Chris Pockel, a veterinary behaviorist who runs a practice in Portland, Oregon, the Animal Behavior Clinic, and is nationally recognized for his expertise in this realm. If you'd like to ask Dr. Pockel a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So I guess if we skip ahead in sort of our time travels here, now in the Dr. Pockel saga, you're operating your own vet practice that truly specializes in assessing animals with behavior issues, and then, as you've given in those two examples already, devising treatment to have both animals and humans be much happier for it. So that was clearly the culmination, and I guess is still where we find ourselves now.
Exactly right. Yeah, but I've been in Portland now for just over 10 years. I moved here in 2010 after operating a house call-based behavior practice in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area in Minnesota from 2004, 2005 until 2010. And so now it's myself, and I have three other associate veterinarians who work with me within the practice, and you know that's our mission, right? We're impacting lives of people and their animals.
Yeah,
this vehicle.
And really, as you already made clear, it's really it's the whole shebang. It's not like, hey, this animal has this issue or that issue. It's this animal has this issue relative to this person or this family. So we have to really kind of address both to have a successful outcome.
Exactly right. You know, I think one of the most common questions that I get from people when they find out what I do is I get this sort of little side question of, well, okay, you can tell me, really, is it the people or is it the animals? And there's sort of this either or conundrum that's there. And the answer, at least in my experience, is that it's not really an either or, it's more of an and. You know, this animal is in some ways not able to function within this environment or this person is not able to understand or relate to the animal in front of them. And so it comes back to the relationship, and then we try to figure out, okay, as we tease that out, maybe we do have an underlying medical issue here for the animal, whether that's a hormonal issue like thyroid disease or whether it's something like arthritis or a pain-related problem that's impacting behavior or whether it's something that's more emotionally driven or whether it's a training issue where we have to sort of tease that out and figure out what are the reasons why, and then what are the things that we can manipulate, change, train, treat, all of those things to impact the way in which that relationship functions. And it's a puzzle every single day, and I'm grateful that I've just got a tremendous team that is as invested in solving that puzzle to the best of our ability as we possibly can.
Yeah, and as you mentioned the team and sing their praises, I'm reminded that kind of prowling around on your website and or I guess maybe an email or two that we exchanged, you make it clear that if somebody is writing in or sending in an email about their animal, that they should really be copying or hitting send all so that the whole team gets information about any given cat or dog or other animal that's being treated there.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and as a team, you know, the doctors, we meet every single week, every Monday. You know, we're talking through the cases that are coming in so that if I'm seeing a case that is, you know, particularly interesting where there's a little piece of it that I'm not quite sure how to navigate, I can immediately pick the brains of other just tremendous clinicians who are able to do that and vice versa. And then we do our trainer rounds on Thursdays, where as my trainers are working through the implementation of behavior modification or behavior change plans, if we hit a hurdle or we want to celebrate a particularly profound moment within that pet or client's journey, we have the opportunity to do that. And it's such an incredible opportunity as a team to share those moments and to continue to gain knowledge from one another in the process.
So, Dr. Pockel, I've already, not surprisingly perhaps, gotten a couple of emails and one text, and so we're going to maybe read a couple of those shortly. But in some ways, I guess the suspense is killing me. What are some behavior issues that you commonly see in your practice?
Yeah, so I would say that there's a couple things that are recurring themes. Much of what we deal with, maybe not all, but much of what we deal with has to do with fear and anxiety. And I think something that is really important for us to understand is that animals, in the big picture, really experience a lot of complex emotions much the same way that people do. And so whether we're talking about a worry that manifests more as anxiety conditions, or there's a specific fear or a negative emotional state around a particular situation or thing or person or animal, we're navigating that, and we're looking at these emotional underlying feelings that these animals are having. And then we look, okay, now how is that showing up? So whether that's showing up as an aggressive response, as an animal is using, you know, a growl or a snap, or if we're talking about cats, it may be scratching or other defensive things to sort of control their environment or to keep themselves safe. In other cases, we're looking more at fear and anxiety as impacting quality of life and the overall experience of that animal as they navigate their day-to-day. And then we see all sorts of other patterns that may not be as related to fear and anxiety, but maybe more about how that animal regulates their level of emotional arousal. So perhaps an unbridled enthusiasm for life that is perhaps causing problems due to the arousal level and impacting their ability to navigate daily situations. Or perhaps we're dealing more with compulsive disorders, or as I mentioned before, some of those medical issues that may be underlying some of these behavior changes, and we can tease that out as well and work as a team with that animal's primary care veterinary team to really help improve their overall life.
Well, that sounds, you know, like there's certainly an array of things, but it sounds like predominantly, as you note, that they're tend to be rooted in fear and anxiety, which may bring us to one of the first emailer questions saying, I'm trying to rehome a cat about 2 years old. He showed up where we TNVR, showed up tame though. After the vet visit and neutering, the person that adopted him after 2 months said he attacked her leg and bit her face. I've had him 1 week and have not experienced anything other than love bites until last night when I was sitting next to him and he bit my arm. How do I get him to stop biting so I can find him a forever home? Thanks.
It's a great question. And first of all, I mean, I can certainly understand how difficult a situation like that can be, not only from the aspect of rehoming and trying to find a long-term place for this animal to really succeed and thrive, but also the emotional impact when we have an animal in our care that aggresses toward us. It's really easy to take that personally, which sometimes factors into how we tease out these variables. Truthfully, when I look at a case like that, it's going to be difficult for me to say with certainty exactly what needs to be done, because there's a lot of variables. And one of the most important things that we know is that aggression, in particular, is very context-specific. So if I were seeing this cat in the clinic, first things first is we would have to get a lot more information to try to figure out, you know, again, was this something that was happening because we had a cat who was, I'm going to use a label here, maybe perhaps a little bit overstimulated, or has been alone all day long and really needs an outlet for some of that, you know, more kittenish energy, which a two-year-old is still not a full adult yet from a cat standpoint. Or is there something about that cat that they may be experiencing a level of pain or discomfort, and perhaps even something that was intended as a loving touch created a painful or discomfort. The level of discomfort for the animal that elicited more of a defensive reaction. And so, as you can probably imagine, those two scenarios, even just those two scenarios, have very different intervention plans to try to figure out what's needed. And that's part of what we do is to try to then figure out and say, okay, based on this factor and this factor and this factor, the most likely reason why is this, and here are two things, four things, five things that we can do to impact that. And then let's see how it works.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens next.
Right. So it sounds like there necessarily in a case like this and many others, there's a certain plan, but there's also a certain amount of trial and error that's kind of inherent to that plan.
Absolutely. I mean, animals, even just like people, we are living, breathing creatures. And so, you know, I'm never going to give a treatment plan that says, if you do this, I can guarantee this outcome. It doesn't work that way. We have to allow for the fact that these are living beings. They are sort of able to make their own choices, right? And so we don't necessarily have full control over exactly what happens next. And so there is a process of learning how to work together, which sometimes is a sort of a novel concept for people, especially if they come from perhaps a more traditional mindset of training where we are able to tell the animal exactly what to do and they will do it. There can be some fallout there. That's not necessarily the modern way of thinking about these relationships. And we can do better in most cases.
Well, let's take a caller and then we'll get maybe back to some more email questions and maybe even if I get lucky, some of my own questions. So let's, hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Pockel.
Great show, Duncan, and hi, Doc. I have a question. I'm really seriously considering getting a dog as a life companion. And I was thinking, you know, it might be better for me to get a puppy because that would allow me to bond a little bit better. And so I'm looking for a dog that will really be a companion, like kind of stand next to me at all times. You know, be really docile and friendly, and but not run away all the time and just stay with me. So do you think it's 90%? So how about the puppy thing? Is that important at all for bonding? And I'm assuming it's 95% love and 5% food. And thanks for being there, Doc. I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your call.
That is such a fantastic question. And we could literally tease that apart for hours.
Right.
If we wanted
this might be a 5-part show, as it turns out, just based on that one question. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The first thing that I wanted to tease out there is the puppy versus adult sort of question. Because that's a really common question. And what I tend to think about is, as an adult, you know, we may not have had as much control over the upbringing of that animal, so that dog may have some quote-unquote baggage that we have to work through. And yet, if we're looking at a dog that's age 3, 3.5, 4, 4.5, they are at a level of maturity where the behavior patterns that we see are more likely to be stable. So if we're looking at that animal, we may have a better chance of saying, hey, this is an adult dog, and I can look for a dog who matches my level of energy and who looks at me adoringly in that way that I want them to do, perhaps is of a breed that is more of a working partner, like some of the herding or hunting breeds, where we're more likely to get some of that sort of partnership and devotion just based on genetics and breed. Versus puppy, yes, there's a blank slate, and there's a blank slate, which means you have a lot of writing to do on that slate, a lot of development, a lot of education, and that's not necessarily always going to lead to that end result that you want. There's a lot of twists and turns along that road, and a lot of places where we can get a little bit off track, either through training or perhaps the development of medical issues or other patterns. And so there's a lot more uncertainty about going from the puppy standpoint. So there are pros and cons of both, and really sort of looking at which is going to be the best fit for you. And then the last piece that I'll mention there, too, is when it comes down to truly developing that relationship with an animal where we get that, I love how the caller said that standing by the side, that the love that's there in the relationship, that is built on trust. And what I love about the vast majority of dogs that we work with is that if given the opportunity, the majority of dogs are willing and ready to show up in a relationship like that once they trust the individual that they're working with. And whether that trust comes through kindness, appropriate care and handling and providing a sense of safety, or whether we are reinforcing specific behavior patterns that allows the animal to feel that there's a certain level of structure and predictability within that relationship, all of those things really show up as trust. And that's where we get that relationship. And that can come either from puppy or adult, but we want to be just mindful about how those influences may affect that long-term goal. I love that question. Again, we could dive in for hours on
yeah.
that. I hope that answers the question.
No, I think that's a great answer, considering that the probably the true extended version, the extended dance mix version even, would be several hours probably to fully address every aspect of the caller's questions. But I think that's a great overview for now. So let's get to another email or question, then I swear we're going to get to at least one or two of mine. But this is this one says, this is Don Goldstein, who, by the way, Dr. Pockle was our, and still is, I guess if anything else comes up, our long-time Greyhound correspondent. So he says, by the way, I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon, now live in Tampa. Does Dr. Pockle notice behavior issues common to specific breeds or regions of the U.S.?
Oh, another great question. So, yes, and I say that with a bit of a question mark at the end, For a couple of different reasons. We know that the genetic basis of individual breeds, let's say greyhounds versus border collies, for example, just to pick some obvious differences, if we want an animal who gives really strong eye and who has, this working drive and really takes direction well and is ready to work for long hours throughout the day, I'm willing to bet that the person who wrote that email is not necessarily attributing those traits to a greyhound, right? Greyhounds are amazing and they do some really phenomenal things very, very well.
Yeah.
But certain traits are more likely to be expressed by certain breeds. And so yes, we are more likely to see certain patterns. Now, the piece that I want to counter that with is that I also want to be clear that I'm never going to assume that every animal of a particular breed, for example, is going to display those characteristics. And using a greyhound example here, sometimes those dogs definitely have a reputation for saying, shouldn't be in a home with small dogs, or let's say with furry cats, for example, because of that chase or prey drive that's there. And yet, the moment we say that, we'll have 37 people raising their hands saying, but my dog does just fine with those, and it's a greyhound. Mm. So we never want to assume that we know exactly what a dog is going to do simply based on breed. And we could talk about that as, examples of border collies that really aren't that good at herding, or retrievers that aren't really that good at retrieving, or some of the other protection dogs that love everybody, right? So yes, they're more likely to show certain characteristics, but it's not an automatic guarantee that those traits are going to show up in every individual within that breed or region.
Gotcha. And that kind of dovetails with one of the questions I was going to ask was, how much does the treatment vary from patient to patient? Like, let's say back to our first emailer, the cat biting thing or some other issue that might come up. It sounds like from what you're saying that there's so many variabilities even within breeds that similarly that a dog or a cat that's showing a certain issue that's why they've come to see you. Even that treatment plan, as you noted earlier, might have a few different stages or a few sort of trial and error elements built into it. So, you know, that cat that we talked about earlier that had the biting issue may respond differently than the next cat that we might talk about or run into that's got a biting issue. So I guess that's just part of why there's the practice that you have with the team that you have, because there's never a one-size-fit-all, even for a very specific kind of issue.
That's exactly right. And what I can say to that is that essentially every treatment plan that either I or one of my team members builds for one of our clients and our patients has three major components. At least we're considering these three major components, and that is, you know, we look at our behavior modification, and we basically define that as what are the skills, behaviors, or emotions that we would, you know, if we could wave the magic wand, what skills or behaviors or emotions would we want this animal to possess to allow them to be more successful in whatever those circumstances happen to be. So that's all about sort of the training, if you will, and behavior mods. But those things take time. Now, not always tremendous amounts of time. It may take a day, a week, a month, a year, depending on how complex the issues are. In the meantime, every plan also has a component of management where we're basically saying, until this animal has the ability to fill in the blank, let's make sure we're keeping that animal out of those situations where they might be engaging in perhaps dangerous behaviors, or they might be practicing those behaviors, quote unquote, doing it wrong. So let's manage that animal appropriately so they're not rehearsing, they're not endangering anyone or their own safety. And then the third piece is really about what I consider the umbrella of medication. Now, medication could be pheromones, it could be pharmaceuticals, it could be nutraceuticals, it could be herb therapy, it could be nutrition, you know, anything that we might add to that plan that may make it easier to onboard those skills. And then I would also put that piece of medical intervention in there as well to basically say, is there something, you know, quote unquote, wrong with that animal that's impacting their behavior patterns? And so while the individual components are going to be very different, every single plan we are considering, what does the animal need to learn or feel? How are we avoiding trouble until the animal has those skills? And is there a role for additional support for that animal? So those consistencies are absolutely there. And then we look at that animal and say, okay, what does this animal need? What is this owner capable of in terms of their knowledge, their skill set, their physical abilities, the environment they live in, and so on? And that's where all of the nuance starts to get layered in.
Yeah, and it sounds like also, too, that's where the human part of the equation has to really understand that you know, it indeed has got some complexity, some variables. It does have the trial and error thing that we've talked about. So, you know, it may take a little while or a little sort of experimentation before really starting to resolve the issue that you did come to see the doctor about.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is Talking Animals on WNF. If you just tune in, I just want to fill you in. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Chris Pockel, a veterinary behaviorist, and we're taking some calls and emails about animals of one kind or another, and we invite you to join the conversation if you'd like by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Okay, before I get back to one of my questions, let's get another caller involved. Hi, you're on the Talking Animals with Dr. Pockel.
I don't know if any of you are dog people. I feel like you're not.
Dr. Pockel, I was wondering, you know, I've got I rescued a, he was on the street, a wonderful pit bull, American pit bull terrier. And, you know, I've trained him to really stay in my yard. I've got a little property here in Tenosa. And I'm thinking of getting another one, and I was wondering about the compatibility of two dogs of that size. He's not human aggressive at all. He gets along with most dogs, but at the dog park, he's had a couple of hits. He was attacked once or twice, and then he did tend to, with bigger dogs, have an attitude and maybe get into it a little bit. Never with small dogs. You know, I was wondering if that would be a wise idea and how I would be able to sort of find out whether they would be, if I found another dog, whether they would get along.
That's a great question. And there's a lot of, I'm going to say, unanswerability within that until we know who the other dog happens to be. I thought it would be almost like saying, hey, I live alone. I want to get a roommate. Is there a guarantee that I'm going to get along with whoever I invite in to share my space? Am I going to develop a relationship with them? Is it going to be just sort of lukewarm and tolerable, or is this really going to be a bad deal? And we don't really know until we know who the other party is. What we can look at is some of the details that you shared about your dog and the fact that, you know, while there certainly are many dogs out there who do seem to have the skill set that allows them to interact and engage comfortably with essentially every other dog, that's not necessarily a universal skill. And so if we say, there are some times where perhaps at a dog park where maybe the arousal level is a little bit high, things can get a little out of hand, or we might have some learning history. As you said, your dog was attacked, and so there may be a little bit of apprehensiveness, especially when engaging with bigger dogs or perhaps dogs who come on a little bit strong or a little bit more assertively, that may be more likely to be problematic. And right. So when I'm working with a client in this particular situation, what we're trying to do is say, well, what do we know about your dog to try to sort of pick the ideal partner as best we can, meaning sometimes we're intentionally choosing a dog of the opposite gender, male versus female, for example, to try to avoid some of the competitive issues that we may see within same gender pairings.
Right.
We may decide, you know, we want a dog that's big enough that they're able to sort of play and roughhouse and do that, but not so big that your existing dog may perceive that newcomer as more of a threat. And, you know, and then we get into some of the other details about, and then how do we navigate the day-to-day routines with feeding and who sleeps where and things of that nature. And those all really factor into that question. And it's not my goal to make this so complicated that we can't answer the question, but also to understand that it's difficult until we know a lot more information.
So you can't really generalize. You just have to sort of bring them together in a neutral place. Hopefully, I know in some shelters they allow you to go and they have an area where the dogs can get to know each other to see if the chemistry is right. I guess that would be a good idea.
Exactly right. Yeah, and we've got all sorts of strategies. Sometimes going for a walk. We sometimes call it a parallel walk, where we have the dogs on leash versus being in an off-leash area. Again, pros and cons of both options. But sometimes going for a parallel walk, we're basically kind of walking shoulder to shoulder versus feeling like we have to be face-to-face with that newcomer and go, oh my gosh, who are you and what do I do next?
Right.
We can get more of a sense of, do these dogs look like they have a desire to engage with one another, or are they more aloof and more distant? And we can try on different pairings and get some information about who this dog's ideal household partner might really be.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's very useful.
Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye. Bye.
So, Dr. Pockel, we've already really established here in your answers and some of your other comments that there's such an array of issues that can develop, and then within that, such an array of sort of treatment plans. But still, I'm just wondering, are there some early warning signs for behavioral issues that we can keep an eye out for? I mean, because I imagine, as with many things, early intervention probably yields, you know, stronger or more promising outcomes. So are there things, just as a general thing, even though, again, we're talking about a number of different issues already that animals experience, that you should say, if we're seeing this could be this, maybe it's time to address this without letting it maybe go any further?
Yeah, there certainly are. I mean, I think, you know, some of the common histories that we see, especially in some of our adolescent dogs, which, as you might be able to predict, we see a lot of adolescent dogs in the practice where, you know, maybe, you know, as we were talking about with the caller about getting the puppy versus the adult, it takes a lot of education to get that puppy through the teenage months and years successfully. And so it's really easy to sort of go off the rails. And so, you know, one of the patterns that we see often in that population is a history that includes comments like, well, I mean, it started out kind of cute. And then it kind of just got worse and worse and worse. And whether that's a pattern of barking at the mailman, whether it's the pattern of chasing after the kids and grabbing onto their pant legs, or whether it's a pattern of, you know, playing keep away with you know, various household items, you know, those things are not in and of themselves a problem. But if that ball rolls just a little bit farther, we can really start to see, especially as that dog gets a little bit older, a little bit more mature, perhaps a bit larger, they start to hit adolescence and now they're becoming a bit more impulsive. And if we don't have the training foundations there yet, we really can run into problems. So, you know, I think it's really about being mindful of, especially when we're talking about puppies and youngsters, what are the behaviors that we are going to want this animal to display basically from age 3 onward, you know, for 8, 10, 12, 15 additional years, and really saying, what now do I need to teach this puppy or this youngster so that we're able to do that and not be, let's say, lulled into complacency by saying, oh, he's just a puppy, he's just playing.
Yeah, so you really want to be able to cultivate those behaviors that you're really hoping to see and not leave gigantic leeway just because, hey, it's a puppy, so therefore, too bad about the shoes or too bad about the whatever.
Exactly. And especially, you know, we know that learning starts right away. I mean, you put a puppy home at 8 weeks, they're already starting to learn about the environment they live in. And we've got tremendous opportunities to really teach them constructively and utilizing positive reinforcement with praise and play and leveraging food reinforcement to really say, hey, these are the things that I want you to do. Please do more of this. And we can kind of crowd out some of those negative or unwanted behaviors simply by providing the reinforcement that animal needs. And if from time to time we need to say, puppy, do this instead, then we now have a framework that allows us to really avoid a lot of those problems by the time we start hitting 9 months, 10 months, 12 months, 15 months.
Yeah. So we're sort of nearing the end of our time, unfortunately, Dr. Paco, but let me try to hit one or two, at least more, of our emailers, text-type questions. One says here, I was curious if your guest has experienced any physical or more specifically neurological and or behavioral benefits from CBD oil.
That's a great question. It's a little bit of a loaded question right now because we don't really know a lot about it. And what I mean by that is that there's very, very little actual research to say which types, which formulations, which strengths, you know, talking about the product, for which behaviors. So is it more helpful for anxiety versus fear? Those things are actually a little bit different. Is it more likely to help for certain breeds or certain ages of dogs? You know, all of these questions are just that, questions. And we have a lot of unanswered questions right now, and that makes it a little bit difficult to say. I've had a lot of anecdotal experience that's all over the map in terms of clients who are saying, hey, I tried X, Y, and Z, and it helped a little. Some clients may say it helped a lot. A lot of them say it's made no difference whatsoever. I don't exactly know where to put all of that right now because, again, we don't have, again, even if we were talking about one product, to then say, okay, now we can start talking about dosages and how frequently and which delivery system. But it is such a, it's a wild west out there in terms of all of the different products and formulations.
Yeah.
It's really difficult as a practitioner to make any sort of conclusions right now.
Yeah, it just sounds like it's just too early in the going for science to have spoken much.
Yeah, I like the idea. I would like to really be happy about it. I just don't have any data that really supports that with confidence yet.
Yeah. All right, well, this might be one of our last questions. This one was sent in as well. This is, my Chihuahua rescue insists on destroying dog beds. If I leave the room, she goes at it now on the old lab's bed. If I catch her, I send her to her now bedless crate. She makes faces but goes voluntarily. She has destroyed even her own tough Kong bed. She has lots of chew toys. She is obsessed and destroys with a passion. Was probably an abandoned puppy mill dog, age about 6. So any input there, Dr. Puckle?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts come to mind there. Whenever I'm thinking about a dog that is continually engaging in a particular pattern, in this case we're talking about a dog that is selectively causing destructive behavior directed towards dog beds, my brain immediately says, what's going on there? You know, is there an unmet need? You know, meaning, do we have a dog that needs more exercise or needs a different sort of training history or something along those lines? Is there an unmet need? Is there something about saying, I'm only going to give you access to dog beds when you're well exercised and you're more likely to just kind of hang out and go to sleep for a little while? Versus, is this a dog who has perhaps learned, and this is just speculation, but perhaps has learned that, hey, these dog beds are amazing. If you grab them with your teeth and you brace with your feet, you can shred and rip, and it's an amazing way to let go of all of your day frustration.
Yeah.
Right? So there may be a self-reinforcing component that the dog is like, yeah, go away, just leave me alone with the dog bed. I have all kinds of fun ideas planned for this one.
Yeah.
That's going to be a different pattern of, you know, that dog is not going to get better with more exercise. We're going to have to teach that dog, you know, what exactly we want them to do with the dog beds. We might decide to give them other outlets for that particular type of activity that they really enjoy. We may also then look at some of the consequences here. And I love that the individual who wrote that question said, yeah, and I'm trying to give the dog some feedback. I'm sending him to his crate, or I'm removing him from the circumstance.
Yeah.
And we kind of think about that in terms of a timeout sort of a consequence.
Right.
And that's actually a really hard way for dogs to learn. They can do it, but it's really, really hard because, you know what, the time for there to be an intervention or a redirection was seconds, minutes, or hours in the past. And so it's a difficult way for dogs to learn. And
yeah.
So in the short term, I would say probably a bit more supervision. We could trial some different types of exercise or enrichment to see if we can provide that pup an outlet that really meets those needs. And we might invest in some more resilient bedding to make it harder to engage in that particular behavior in the short term while we're teaching this pup what exactly we want him to do.
Well, fair enough. I think that's great, and you provided a bunch of great information for our callers and our emailers and texters. We have reached the end of our time. So we've been speaking with Dr. Chris Puckle, and that's spelled P-A-C-H-E-L. The practice, the clinic, is animalbehaviorclinic.net. That's the website. He also has his own website, drpockle.com. So, Dr. Puckle, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. I think we all learned a lot and have renewed hope for some of our animals with whatever issues they may have.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you this morning and to share some valuable information with your listeners as well. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. Take care. Okay, so in a moment, I'll speak with Magic Ishmaili, who runs Zaxi Bird Sanctuary in Tampa, where he cares for more than 200 parrots, but he's apparently embroiled in a dispute with a neighbor, which has resulted in losing access to the road in and out of the sanctuary, leaving Ishmaili isolated, meaning he seems to be caring for and feeding all the birds by himself. We'll hear from him shortly. Right now, that we're going to step into the Comedy Corner. I figured in the wake of my conversation with Dr. Puckle, we should probably do something dog-related. This is Max Rosenblum with a piece called Dog People in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I don't know if any of you are dog people. I feel like you're not a dog person unless you bring your dog in to bring your kid to work day. That's when you know you're a dog person. My coworker Jackie loves dogs. She came into work one day, 9 a.m., burst through the door. She's like, Max, you wouldn't believe it. I was out walking Sadie last night, and someone was walking their cat. And I was like, okay, to be fair, that is unusual. But I find it hilarious that people scoff at the idea of people treating their cats like dogs, but they have no problem at all treating their dogs like humans. Do you know what I mean? It's like, where do you get off being like, I'm sorry, are you walking your cat right now? My dog cannot enjoy his brunch while you're walking your cat right now. It is so distracting. My fully clothed dog cannot enjoy his mimosa with your cat on a leash. You guys have been wonderful. My name is Max Rosenblatt.
Unfortunately, we don't seem to have Mr. Ishmaili. Got voicemail at the sanctuary, even though I had confirmed the interview with him yesterday. So I may try one more time in our remaining moments, see if I get lucky then. Otherwise, we're going to have to see if we can schedule him for another time. So I'm going to try one more time. This is Talking Animals on WNF. Okay, good news. We have Majid Ishmaili on the phone here. Hi, welcome to Talking Animals. Mr. Ishmaili? Well, it's just one of those days, or it's become one. Stand by. Okay, Mr. Ishmaili?
Ishmaili.
Okay. Thank you for joining us on Talking Animals. Unfortunately, with the not being able to reach you, we're sort of super limited on time. But give me a brief description, if you will. I would have originally asked about the sanctuary, but let's just talk about kind of what has happened that's prevented you from being able to get in and out of the sanctuary and therefore, I guess, compromise your ability to feed and care for the birds.
Very good. We are landlocked. Landlocked is not legal in Florida. And that means all around us, there is someone else's property that we cannot trespass. I did have a contract when I bought the land that we are going to have easement. But they said because I recorded my sales contract, I voided my easement to my property. And this is not legal, and I did not write the contract. Number one. Number two, before I recorded my contract, they put a lock on me and they stopped me from coming to the property. That means they breached their own contract. But unfortunately, I've been here over 100 days. We need food. We need many materials.
So what do you think in light of that? What do you think are the next steps towards resolving this and you know, regaining access or creating new access to the sanctuary?
There is no new access. Legally and by law, it cannot be another access. That is the only access. I do have an attorney that appealed the decision, but maybe the judge didn't have all the facts. But that is the only way to get in and get out. There is no other way.
I see. All right. Well, I'm afraid, given the difficulty reaching and some of the other problems that happened when we lost the call, et cetera, that we're out of time, but maybe we could follow up in a subsequent show. So good luck to you, and we hope you find some resolution to this soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, this is the tail end of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Loray is up next after NPR News headlines. Next week, my guest will be William Neal, writer-director of Long Gone Wild, a documentary that picks up where Blackfish left off. So look forward to speaking with him. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Brandon Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond NPR News.